Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist, writer and broadcaster, Pete Perfides.
Hello. Hi. Thank you very much for asking me to do this. I'm honoured. Having looked at some of the previous people that have done it, I'm very grateful.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I see your book, Broken Greek, is currently appearing in all the best of music book reviews.
It's made it into a few, and I didn't dare expect anything remotely along these lines. So, I know how many books kind of roughly come out every week, and the idea that mine should have been remembered by anyone at this time of year is just a huge win for me. So, it's amazing. Yeah. The stuff of dreams.
Yeah. And well deserved. In your book, you describe how from the age of 4 to 7, you didn't really speak and took refuge in music.
Mm.
So was that when you discovered the Beatles?
I discovered Beatles before I discovered the Beatles. I discovered Paul McCartney. I think the very first experience I can remember with a Beatle is My Sweet Lord. When I was very young, in the summer, my parents would close their fish and chip shop for a month or so. And we'd embark on these long kind of cross-European car journeys to get to Greece and Cyprus, where my parents were from. And I have a sort of very clear memory of a sort of nodding off, kind of on my mother's lap, I guess, whilst My Sweet Lord was playing on the car stereo. Mm-hmm. And that song was just the sound, you know, in a kind of way I couldn't articulate to myself. It was just the sound of safety. It was the sound of security. I mean, that song does that to you anyway, and it's done it to my kid, yeah. My kids subsequently. And, my youngest daughter in particular is obsessed with the Beatles and with that album, with All Things Must Pass, especially. In particular, My Sweet Lord and the song All Things Must Pass are totemic songs for her. They've helped her through some very hard times. And so it's kind of lovely to see that echoed down the generations. And then My Love Kintyre was the first time I was aware of, you know, I could put a face to the song watching the video to My Love Kintyre on top. And I write about this in my book, Broken Greek. Paul was the archetypal groovy dad. Paul and Linda were the archetypal groovy parents. And I just wanted to be enveloped in this fetal cocoon of loveliness that was My Love Kintyre. I wanted to be in that setup, you know, the hearth-like glow of that song. And the bagpipes. So people are going about the bagpipes. I don't believe people when they say they don't like the bagpipes. And I think, you know, they're hugely moving. It's like an emotional outpouring, yeah. And what's not to love? So I only found out that Paul McCartney had been in the same group as John Lennon on the day after John Lennon heard being killed. And I was very lucky. There was a girl called Jed who lived next door to me. She was 4 years older than me, and she was kind of like a sort of a big sister, a sister type character in my life. And she would play me records. She would sort of turn me on to stuff. And John Lennon, as far as I was concerned, John Lennon was the guy that did Just Like Starting Over, which is why I listened with immense kind of interest to your EggPod, your podcast with Annie Nightingale, because it was just, it was amazing to get her perspectives on a record I absolutely loved, and Just Like Starting Over, which again was, you know, I didn't really know that it was uncool to love John Lennon, the romantic, the doting husband, the loving father. I didn't realise it was cooler to like his kind of angry political solo stuff from earlier on in the decade. That was my idyll of love, adult love, was kind of encapsulated in a handful of songs, and that was one of them, a couple of others. Anyway, so we went next door. Jed's family seemed far sadder about John Lennon's death than my parents did. My parents were sad, but they were Greek, and, John Lennon wasn't really a big character in their cultural universe. But it was majorly sad times happening next door. So I kind of went next door, and Jed mentioned almost in passing that you know, the, about Paul McCartney having been in the Beatles. I was like, hang on. Paul McCartney from Wings was in the Beatles. He said, yeah, didn't you know? I said, no, I didn't know. They're in the same, this is amazing. They were in the same band. Yeah, they were best friends. They formed the band together, you know, and she played. I just thought it was, you know, it was like a super group. The Beatles were, you know, if time went backwards, they'd be a super group. And then she played me "I Am the Walrus," and then I sort of heard, you know, that was doubly amazing because I thought, oh, okay. So that's kind of the kind of egg out of which ELO hatched, basically.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so that's a lot of rubber. And then to cap it all off, she lent me the Beatles oldies album, the first Beatles kind of collection of well-known songs. And I took it home, and it was just like a series, like a sequence of fireworks kind of going off in my you know, because, like, you know, blam, you know, she loves you, I want to hold your hand, you know, and so on and so on. And it was just like, I felt like I was reliving, you know, I was living through this kind of revolution that I'd missed the first time around. I'd never forget it. It was that side one, especially of that record, just blew my mind, really, you know. So thank you, Jed, forever grateful. And that's part one, you know, she's one of the people that my book is a sort of love letter to, in a way, is Jed, for that kind of influence she had on my life at that time.
So the album you've picked is Paul McCartney and Wings' 1973 album, Band on the Run. So why did you pick this one?
The prosaic answer is, from the list of albums that were still available, is it was just my favourite. And I'm quite shocked that no one chose it previously. I almost felt like a trap, you know, that no one had chosen it. It's like, is there something I've... You know, is it like the brown acid or something? It's a why has no one chosen this record? I thought the sort of QI klaxon would go off if I chose it. But I'm very happy. God, I'm so happy to talk about Band on the Run. Yeah.
So the album, which is credited to Paul McCartney and Wings, was released in time for the Christmas of 1973, just a fortnight after John's Mind Games album. And it was a double Grammy Award winner and Rolling Stone magazine's 1974 Album of the Year. But its origins began in Paul's High Park farm in Kintyre, where he wrote most of the songs. Then, in early August, the band headed off to his farm for rehearsals. And it was during these rehearsals lead guitarist Henry McCulloch quit. Then, just as they were set to fly to EMI Studios in Lagos, which Paul had chosen after discovering a list of all the studios across the globe, and he thought this one might be exotic, drummer Denny Sywell phoned to say he was quitting too. However, Paul decided to continue, and so he, Linda, Denny Lane and engineer Jeff Emmerich headed off, only to discover the studio was barely usable. During their stay, Paul and Linda were mugged, the demos were stolen, so they had to commit the songs to tape from memory, and then when they flew back, further work was done in Air Studios in London in October 73.
Stuck inside these four walls, sent inside forever, never seeing no one nice again like you.
So we start with Band on the Run, which was written in 1972. It was a single in June 74, reaching number 3. 6 months later it was released. First two parts recorded in Lagos, and the final part in Air Studios.
The first version of Band on the Run actually had was the 25th anniversary edition that I think came out in 1999, the double CD. And I knew some of the songs on it, but as listening to it all the way through, and very shortly afterwards, I secured myself an original vinyl copy, which I'm glad I did, actually, because those first pressings of Band on the Run are real. I mean, I'm not...
Yes, yeah.
People don't, you know, people sort of think I will evangelize about vinyl over any other format at any cost. But the main reason why I like records is just because I just like how they look, and I like to hold them, and I like to... It's better for reading the lyrics. And, you know, if it sounds good, then obviously that's great. You really notice how good the those first pressings of Band on the Run are. You notice it straight away with that song, you know. And I love Band on the Run, the song. It's just one of the great opening tracks of all time. And it has that sort of us against the world energy, which, you know, I sort of think that you have when you're a touring band and you're playing venues trying to establish yourself. And, you know, I like kind of putting it into, trying to imagine it in kind of historical context. I like the fact that it was his sixth post-Beatles album, fifth or sixth?
It's his fifth.
Fifth. But actually, you know, in one sense, he's sort of established himself as a prolific artistic entity. But actually, you know, I love going back to old music papers and seeing what, you know, what the general vibe around the sort of ex-Beatles is. And, you know, they just won't let the Beatles lie, you know.
No.
They won't, will they? Have you noticed that? No.
Yeah.
It's, you know...
Well, I think, bear in mind, 73, that they would have also released the Red and Blue albums.
Yes. Yeah.
So they would have been... Everybody would have been thinking about the Beatles again, wouldn't they?
And, you know, it's kind of doing better than some of those solo albums in the charts. And it's certainly kind of competing with them very evenly. You know, one week it's above some of them and the next week it's slightly below them. And, you know, they're constantly being... Every week, in every music baby, they're constantly being asked about the Beatles. And, you know, will they get back together? And none of them seems to want to issue an outright denial, which I think is... sort of interesting. They're kind of...
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think at this time, because obviously Alan Klein, the Apple wranglings, that was kind of over. Mm. Once they got through that, then there was no reason why they couldn't work together. And I think they got over the worst of it. John and Paul got over the arguments. So there was, well, why not? But I think generally they kind of say three of us were up for it, but one wasn't at any particular time.
Yeah. There's a great on in Melody Maker on July the 6th, it's about a month before they go off to Lagos to record Band on the Run.
Yeah.
And Melody Maker asks Paul if he feels like the other Beatles are missing out by not touring, which at this point, Paul's been doing a lot of. And he replies, it's up to them what they fancy doing. It just depends if they'd enjoy it. If they'd enjoy it, then yes, they're missing out. I know Ringo just said he would never consider touring again. I don't know if he ever will, but I just like the sort of, I think nonchalant Paul is so funny. I think he doesn't get credit for being that kind of nonchalant deadpan character. And on the same day, you know, he talks about David Bowie recently disbanding the Spiders from Mars, which is a move that a lot of people mean that he's going to quit touring forever. And Paul goes, I don't know why he's giving up. I should have asked him. I met him last night at the premiere of Live and Let Die. I think it's a pity. I'll tell you why it's a pity. It's because I haven't seen his show yet, and I'd like to see it. So come on, David, just do a quick one for me. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And
it is, yeah.
The kind of the perpetual blindness. And the blindness is a great, obviously, is one of the great weapons in his armoury for just offsetting kind of close scrutiny and kind of creating this, manufacturing this cocoon of sort of normality around him. And you know, he's had that device all his life. But, you know, they're constantly, so it's Beatles, Beatles, Beatles all the time. And, you know, that there's like... A kind of news story that's kind of rolling on at the time is that Alan Williams has been doing the rounds trying to sell these newly discovered Star Club tapes.
Yeah.
And you know, he's going to the music press trying to sort of basically get, you know, get Apple to buy them, getting someone, you know, just getting a bit of interest in them. And that's often kind of emulating what they're doing in the present tense. And then, you know, Robert Stigwood's rehearsing his Sgt. Pepper stage production, which is going to, you know, eventually will become one of the worst films ever.
Have you seen it?
I have, yeah, have you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's incomprehensible.
I don't know where to begin.
It's just incomprehensible, isn't it? They couldn't even save it in the edit. I just don't know what's going on in it. I mean, if people think, you know, magical mystery tour is hard to follow, this is, you know.
It is another level. But it has got Frankie Howard in it, which is nice.
Yeah, just, you know, it's so confusing to watch Peter Frampton standing there next to the Bee Gees. Just sort of, you know, they've all signed on the dotted. I mean, the Bee Gees, you know, famously would just do anything that Robert Stigwood told them to do. But, you know, Peter Frampton Johnny Flynn must feel a little bit like Peter Frampton must have felt. Like Johnny Flynn, who's currently being very quiet about his involvement as David Bowie in this biopic of David. And that's kind of attracted a certain amount of ridicule. So if you think about, you know, the kind of resonances of the title Band on the Run, you know, they're sort of on the, they're on the run in all sorts of ways. You know, Paul's, he's on the run from the Beatles in a way, and, you know, they're on the run because they're touring. And, you know, you can sort of imagine they've just done their they've done the kind of Student Unions tour the year before.
Yeah.
But they've just done their sort of, be it their first proper tour of theatres throughout the spring months, and so I can sort of imagine Paul kind of working up. I don't know exactly where and when he wrote it, but I can sort of imagine him working up something around the theme of being a band on the run, because that's kind of what they are literally at that point. So I like you know that kind of camaraderie thing, sort of coalescing into a song. So I'm kind of guessing that maybe the beginnings of the song are sort of maybe rooted in the touring, but obviously taking in other sort of, you know, other kind of meanings. But I love, it's kind of Paul kind of flexing his songwriting muscles.
Oh, yeah.
In a really kind of super assured way, you know, and no one really goes on about what a great lyricist Paul is. But he kind of...
Absolutely, yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, this is the man who wrote Eleanor Rigby. And, you know, so on his day, he's written lyrics that stand shoulder to shoulder with the best of all time. No doubt about it. Yeah. And so I really like, you know, he can do a lot of heavy lifting with one line, Paul, you know. So all I need is a pint a day, you know, that... It's that sort of, you know...
Yeah.
British stoicism in seven or eight words, but also probably a reference to the overwhelming nature of being him and the scrutiny that, you know, isn't really letting up. So it's like, how much do I really need to be happy? And that's the question that Linda posed kind of quite early on in their relationship, you know, when all's said and done, what do you really need? And, you know, that's, you know, he talks about Linda having... being that sort of having had that influence. So I love that kind of, and when you've been in love, I don't know, certainly I remember when my wife Catelyn and I sort of fell in love, and the first thing we did as a couple, we just got into the car and we just drove. It was February, so we didn't have to book hotels or anything, and we just drove up north as far as we could go for 2 weeks. So for me, that it really kind of echoes that sense of, like, we're in love, we're together, and as long as we have each other, we can just sack it all off. And you get that sort of defiance in the final verses where, you know, he goes, in the town they're searching for us everywhere, but we never will be found. That's just so romantic. Yeah. And
but that was Paul and Linda would do that, wouldn't they? That's the two of us.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's just lovely, you know. So it's kind of intimate, but also it's vast, you know, and that kind of, it always catches me unawares when it goes, do, 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 and then that kind of, yeah. And that, on the record, I remember putting the vinyl album on for the first time, and it really kind of carried that really well. It's the orchestration, that's all Tony Visconti, isn't it?
Yeah, Yeah.
And I can sort of see why he was a bit pissed off when he was just, he just got a thank you on the original. He's got he got special thanks on the original.
Cheers.
Yeah. But I think he's now kind of down as the kind of orchestrator or something. Yeah, no, it's just wonderful. I love it to bits.
Yeah. In early August, they were headed off to Paul's Scottish Farm for rehearsals, during which lead guitarist Henry McCulloch quit the band, and he'd been unhappy for quite a while. You forget at the time, Paul's money was all tied up in Apple. So
yeah,
the bands were on a retainer of 70 quid.
And Henry was really unhappy about that, wasn't he?
Yeah. It's easy now to think, well, yeah, if he'd stayed. And also, Denny Sywell was on the same.
That's
but
right.
But obviously, Denny Lane, he'd been through thick and thin with them, so he was getting a bit more. But you can understand how divisions would emerge.
Yeah, he could do really well as a session drummer. So he was going back to America, and he said he could earn up to $2,000 a week as a session drummer, but he was getting £70 a week retainer. And Henry got... there's this kind of in Tom Doyle's book, which is fantastic, Man on the Run, Paul McCartney in the 70s.
Yeah.
He says that Paul sort of upbraided him for playing a show with the singer Carol Grimes. And he says that, well, you know, you're a member of Wings, so you got to be, you know, that's the deal. Yeah. So he's kind of in Iowa's kind of inflamed further by that. So the day before, they were sort of out of the picture, weren't they? And they would go, Paul and Linda and Denny Lane were off to Lagos the following day, and they just had to sort of just get on with it, didn't they? As a threesome. So that's... Yeah.
Denny's was literally about an hour before the flight.
Was it? That okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was really angry. Paul said, you know, subsequently, that he was very angry about that, and he didn't really sort of hide how angry he was. Ginger Baker, who was living in Lagos at the time, got it into his head that they were going to record the album in his studio. So, you know, Ginger, you know, if they did, maybe Ginger would have ended up playing drums on Band on the Run. There could be a version of Band on the Run with Ginger Baker on it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It would be a very, very different album, I think.
Well, it would. You know, it's hard to... Who knows? You know, Paul's drumming is very effective, but he doesn't overreach his own abilities. And so all the fills are very sort of... Whenever he does a fill, he kind of almost kind of stops what he's doing and kind of very almost mechanically goes into a fill. And, you know, it's fine, it works. But I do sort of sometimes wonder what a version with Denny or even Ginger Baker might have been like.
I do love Paul's drumming. I think what I love about this album as well, obviously the bass and the drums, the rhythm section, are a Beatle. And when you hear it, Paul's impatience, and he just keeps doing random fills here and there.
Yes,
and he won't do a standard because he'll just get bored. Well, I'll try this.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally every track. I love that. And that's supposed to be the solid rhythm section.
I mean, I imagine Ringo playing those songs because there's a lot of lollop room on the, you know, that lovely kind of lugubrious quality that Ringo's drumming has. There's room for that on this record. But, you know, it's like, as Paul himself said about the White Album, it's the bloody White Album, shut up.
To Jet, which was another single released in February 1974.
Jet was actually one of the songs that my got my kids into Paul at a really, really early age.
Oh, wow.
And especially Dora, my oldest daughter, Dora, who's now 19. We went to see Paul headlining Glastonbury. And I think at that point, Dora might have been 3.5, I think. And she knew that Paul McCartney was the Jet man. That's all she knew about Paul McCartney. And, so he was the conduit for this song that she loved, and she knew we were going to see Paul McCartney that night. And so the sheer excitement of seeing him do that kept her awake until his set. And I hoisted her up on my shoulders, because that's the only way she was going to get a view in front of the pyramid stage. And thankfully, did it right at the beginning of the set. I put her on my shoulders, and we just danced, you know, and it was, you know, like pure elation. And for about 5 minutes after it ended, she was fast asleep in her buggy, you know. And that, so that was, she was holding out for that moment. So, but I like, you know, it's, Jet is another example of how, what a relaxed songwriter Paul McCartney is. And I can only put that down to the fact that he just never ever stopped. So he was always in receive mode. The most, you know, it's like with any creative act, the most important thing to do is start. And so Jet, you know, depending on what you read, Jet is, you know, most likely named after a pony that he and Linda own.
Yeah, there's two versions, aren't there? One's about a dog, one's about a pony.
But... yeah, and then it sort of transmogrifies into this lyric that most likely seems to be about Linda's dad, about being kind of slightly intimidated by the prospect of gaining the approval of the father of the person you love. And which I think is kind of, I've seen in a couple of places, is sort of confirmed that you know, that's definitely a big element of the song. It's just freighted with this, it's just the energy charge of it, isn't it? And that's that was one of the songs where the whole thing was done when they came back.
Yeah, well, that's it. They did, because the Lagos studios, which were a complete nightmare, were 8-track. So they took a lot of them back, put them on 16 so they could overdub. But this was done all at George Martin's Air Studios.
It does kind of figure in a way, isn't it? Because there's a sort of... the energy of it just suggests a kind of big space, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, well, there's an isolated vocal track...
right.
Which you can't really hear in the record, but you can feel it, is when they're at the beginning, where they go, Jet! What you can't hear is them stomping their feet really loudly. And it's blaringly loud, but in the actual overall song, it's just a feeling rather than it.
Yeah.
So, but it is, it feels like it's marching for, it's an amazingly powerful song.
Yeah, the keyboard, Linda's keyboard playing on it is just sublime. And saxophone, sort of four times over, I think they kind of had either the same saxophone part four times, or four saxophonists. I think Harry Casey, I think his old friend, played sax. And he was great at those at the time, wasn't he? Obviously, I lump it in my mind now, I bracket it with Live and Let Die, because it's just sort of, it's like a rocket taking off, isn't it? And so it has a it's a literally irresistible force. More than any other songwriter, Paul McCartney, you can really rear your children to his music. There are so many, well, actually, and the Beatles, so, you know, but there were so many songs that, not just things like Yellow Submarine and Octopus's Garden, but, you know, I taught my kids about opposites by playing them Hello, Goodbye. I mean, any way I could attempt to teach them about opposites wouldn't be as good as playing them that song.
Yeah.
It just does the job, you know. But even things like, you know, a child's, the kind of malleability of a child's imagination. You play them a song like Nowhere Man, and they imagine the Nowhere Man, I think, with a vividness that almost adults might sort of struggle to do so. They completely get what Nowhere Man is. You know, it's amazing. And Jet, you know, Jet was definitely one of those.
Late at night when the wind is still, I'll come flying through your door, and you'll know what love is for. I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird, I'm a bluebird.
Track 3, Bluebird, written in 1971 during a holiday in Jamaica.
What are your favourites on the album?
On the album, probably 1985. Oh. It's difficult because Jet and Band on the Run are so brilliant, but they're so overheard that they're too big.
Mm.
They're kind of the obvious ones, but I think 1985 for me, but then I hear this and think, well, maybe, you know, it's difficult. Changes per track.
I think one of the great things about Paul as a lyricist is he just always chooses the right words, and it's a sort of Gnostic sort of, you know, obviously he's, that's just soaked into his bones from such a young age. And like Bluebird is an example of, you know, just the sweet, simple sort of romanticism of the second verse, especially, actually. So, I mean, I think this is the Paul that we've come to idolise in retrospect. The Paul on the sleeve of McCartney, the kind of the doting dad who somehow seems to project, you know, in those days, to a certain generation, to an older generation, that kind of masculinity would have been seen as emasculating. And I remember even when I became a dad, you know, my dad, who, you know, is a good man, but he's an unreconstructed Greek Cypriot guy, who, you know, it was very worrying to him that I was just spending so much time doing the childcare, you know, that, like, secretly, maybe I didn't want to, maybe I was under the thumb. And so, you know, it's very inspirational to see the Paul of that, you know, someone who reinvents masculinity as sensitivity, as just caring, doting, you know, all these qualities which traditionally had been seen as more feminine qualities. But at the same time, every woman I know, if you show her the sleeve of McCartney, they don't think he's emasculated. some rather deep feelings get stirred when Paul with the Paul with the beard, you know, bearded Paul out in the country. You know,
a lot of the, you know, masculinity at the time would be things like Hammer of the Gods. You know, Zeppelin was seen as masculine. And then you were on the other side, I suppose, Bowie and Mark Bolan. But Paul was kind of, he wasn't in the middle, but he was just on a completely different level, you know.
No, it's amazing. I mean, another version of masculinity was the sort of getting your head together in the country one, the sort of... But actually, I think we've come to realise that that was just a rebranding of the old masculinity. So, you know, certainly, you know, the kind of the man needs a maid kind of that. But, you know, people like John Martin, who sort of wore the Afghan coats, but actually when push came to shove, you know, their wives still ended up at home looking after the babies, kind of saying bye-bye to their careers, whilst they went off sort of, like, you know, went on the road and did all the things you do on the road. So, hey, Paul, you know, Wingspan, you know, if you like watching the Wingspan DVD, as we did frequently when my kids were younger, you know, that is just the powerful nature of watching this guy take his family on the road, and they're all together, and that, you know, he's in a band with his wife. These are all just such beautiful things, unusual things for the time. And so, and that really feeds into Bluebird for me. So when he sort of God, you know, touch your lips with a magic kiss and you'll be a bluebird too, and you'll know what love can do. I mean, that's like the Tao of Paul, you know, in as represented in those lines. But, you know, human will as the main driver of happiness. And you believe him, and one of the reasons you believe him is because of what he's already been through, especially in his early life. You have a choice. You know, what do you do with the adversities that you've inherited? Or at least Paul made it seem like a choice, because he chose, you know, he made such great decisions. And I sometimes feel sorry for John, you know, who has to, roughly around the same time, had to burst every sinew to project the conjugal idyll that Paul seems to be able to achieve so effortlessly, which sort of ultimately defeats the point, you know. And actually, I remember a few years ago when my youngest daughter was at that height, you know, we'd watched Anthology, we'd watched loads of other documentaries, and we were just kind of gobbling up any footage we could get hold of. We watched Wingspan, and we were so affirmed. We were so, you know, Wingspan made us so happy that we thought, okay, well, let's watch Give Me Some Truth now. And
right, how'd that go down?
Well, it's just so depressing, you know. And that's you know, it's sort of it's just heartbreaking in a way, because, you know, it's the atmosphere is so dark on that, you know, and John doesn't really look like he's very much fun to be around. And it's such a sort of contrast. But
I wonder, I mean, the story about when they were kids, how, I mean, Paul was talking about this recently, how when John came round his house, he couldn't believe it. You know, it was all family get-togethers, singing around the piano.
Yeah.
And obviously with his childhood, he just couldn't get his head around it.
Yeah.
But also, I wonder if it's come the split, it was all about the Fluxus movement, you know, be honest, write about your honest feelings. And somebody was on here before saying, when John's doing Plastic Ono Band, you forget at the same time, he was still buying Mimi a house in Dorset. And he was doing interviews with Kenny Everett doing Laughing Policeman impressions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's what he put down on tape and what he projected, whereas Paul put the nice bits, you know.
Yeah.
The happy bits.
Well, I think, you know, what John was putting down on tape was less unusual in a way. You know, that was, I think, you know, he had this, John was doing edgier things, which were being kind of affirmed by sections of the music press who were positively reinforced creative acts, which sort of chimed with the counterculture. And so what, you know, what Paul did, I think, you know, I think a lot of people would agree now, it's kind of braver in a way, or at least more sort of far-sighted. But John kind of bore a much heavier load than he needed to. And that, you know, I think actually that's what breaks my heart about, you know, watching him in the studio and giving some truth. The elephant in the room is Paul, and John's fury towards Paul is heartbreaking. I mean, you feel like it's eating him up, how much he needs him. And, you know, I remember watching Klaus Voormann playing bass on songs about what an awful person Paul is. And Klaus looks embarrassed. He looks like he doesn't really want to be a part of it. And the more angry John is, the more sort of, you know, this is like a split screen, isn't it? And you see, like, you know, I would have been a fly on the wall when they're recording Bluebird or something. So obviously they got into trouble, didn't they, with Fela Kuti, who kind of paid them a visit just to make sure they weren't using any Nigerian musicians. appropriating.
Well, he was kind of worried, about appropriating the music. And he got in with the local music press as well and, you know, beware this man. And I think once he heard a few tracks, it's like, you're right.
Yeah. But Bluebird's like, ironically, Bluebird actually ended up featuring a Nigerian musician because Remy Kabaka ended up playing percussion on it, I think.
That's it, back in studios.
Yeah.
Whose
son is now a member of Gorillaz. Remy Kabaka.
No way!
Remy Kabaka Jr., he kind of co-wrote the current Gorillaz. He seems to have a more kind of prominent role in Gorillaz than he's ever had before. It's a bit maligned, isn't it, this song? But I can't understand that at all. I don't, you know, it's like people just expect you to agree with them when they tell you that they think Mrs. Vanderbilt isn't a very good song. And I just do not get that at all. I mean,
if you've heard it live, it will blow your head off.
Yeah. And again, it's got these classically Paul sentiments, like, what's the use of worrying? And goes down to that kind of almost Paul's will to power, you know, like, you know, when Friedrich Nietzsche kind of penned the term will to power, it assumed a far more ominous tone than Paul's version. Paul's is like, you know, just you have to stay positive. But in the grain of the song, it's not banal, you know. When the harmony on what's the use of worrying is actually, there's just something quite yearning and plaintive about it. So it's sort of, there's sadness soaked into it. You know, I just think it's a sort of, this is a song I would play to my daughter, I think, when, you know, if she's fretting about my oldest one, who kind of shoots films and does photo shoots, and often she frets about the preparations that she's got to do and how much time she has to play. This is the kind of song I would try and play to her. She probably wouldn't thank me, but...
Well, it bounces along, doesn't it?
And everything in it is catchy, isn't it? So it's just that hey-ho, you know, that it just drives it home, doesn't it? And REM have got a song called Finest Work Song, but I think this is a finer work song, because this is a song that you could actually sing at work, and sort of feeds into the collective spirit of the enterprise, you know, band on the run, all for one, you know, it's kind of in that sort of, and again, Paul's drum fills are basic, but you don't really question it. And I like, again, you go again, that sort of referencing of another Briton. So I didn't know, Mark Lewison's liner notes point out that the opening lines are adapted from Charlie Chester's radio show, where he goes, down in the jungle, living in a tent, better than a prefab, no rent. I think that was the
Tarzan sketch.
Yes.
But the saxophone, again, is Howie Casey. Ooh. And again, this is old... Liverpool friends Derry and the Juniors, but it really reminds me of a Bowie saxophone solo.
Mm. Oh yeah, it has that yearning quality, I think, and it's. Mm. I guess they knew each other from way back, so Paul knew what he was getting, and Howie knew what Paul wanted, and so maybe that's why it works. Nothing feels strained or forced, and that's just part of what's fantastic about it.
Let Me Roll It.
What do you think of Let Me Roll It?
For years I was convinced it was about John, but it seems it isn't, according to Paul.
No, it is.
Whether he wants it to or not.
Do you mean that it's about John in as much as sonically it's about John?
Sonically, and that the actual phrase, Let Me Roll It, which is ironically a George phrase.
Yeah.
But it forever will be about John, whatever Paul says.
No, so far, you know, Paul often says in his own interviews that he's often not fully aware of, didn't he sort of say that decades later he underwent therapy and he came to the conclusion that Yesterday was about his mother? I like that. I like the fact that there is that kind of line taken from the George song, I'd Have You Anytime, because it kind of echoes what George did with Something, which he got from the James Taylor song. And I like the fact that they're still kind of almost once removed, they're still sort of collaborating with each other, you know. He's, Let Me Roll It, you know, he's got, you know, the shadow of John, as you say, looms large over Let Me Roll It, and you know, people thought that it was like a pastiche or something. Paul maintains that it's because of his use of echo, which is used in the same way that John used echo. I remember my youngest daughter, Evie, the one I mentioned earlier on Paul's last tour, we couldn't get tickets to see him in London, but we could get tickets to see him in Glasgow. And so I hatched a plan for us to go and see him. It was the last day. She had her mock exams, and we hatched a plan. I'd pick her up from school on Friday lunchtime. She didn't have anything in the afternoon. I'd reserved sort of our seats on the train. The idea was that we'd go back on the sleeper train, you know, like a 24-hour adventure, you know, and she'd never seen Paul before. You know, this is a girl who, she knows, she should be doing this. She knows way more about Paul than I do. And I'm seriously, because, you know, when you're young, you're like a sponge. You absorb everything. You know? She's got all the books. There's nothing.
Hence why you and me have both got notes.
Exactly.
She recorded this 20 years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we sort of got there. And so I remember Let Me Roll, you know, like, got a song like Let Me Roll, which is why I guess he's played it all these years, but it kind of absolutely comes into its own live. And he talks about enjoying, you know, like it's hard to kind of come up with something that sort of sounds truly original, a lick that sounds truly original. And so his happiness at having done that with Let Me Roll, it, I guess, means it's part of the reason why it's in the set. That was one of the best days of my life, actually, seeing. Going just as a sort of father and daughter together, going on this sort of adventure, and, you know, seeing it through her eyes. And we were two blocks back, and obviously, with security being what it is, you have to rigidly stay in your block. And she, you know, at that point, she was quite sort of shy. You know, she wasn't like typical of her to do what she was about to do, but she said that he the intro to Letting Go started. For people who don't know, Letting Go is a track from Venus and Mars, and both one of our favourite songs. And we were in the back of the second block. We had a reasonable view, you know, pretty good view, actually. And she said, "Dad, I just can't stay here any longer. I'm just going to have to finesse my way to the front." And I remember using the word finesse because I'd never heard young people use it in a different way. You know, finesse is when you just basically, like, you know, scam or kind of somehow do something underhand to get the result that you want. Yeah. And I said, "You might get thrown out, you know, look, just be careful, right? You don't sort of get, you know." And it was like she was invisible. She was like she shapeshifted. I saw her just sort of like kind of glide through security like a kind of master pickpocket or something. And she made it to the front. She just kind of like, she just finished her journey. There was like one row where one of the people in the row was slightly more in, away from the aisle than all the other rows. So she just very calmly stopped and just stayed there. And I just could see her in the distance, dancing to Letting Go. And, you know, obviously, very proud moment. So we had to kind of run. It was a bit like A Hard Day's Night. We had to run all the way back to the station to get on our sleeper train. Which just added to the excitement, obviously.
Of course, yeah. I think I love about this as well on the recording itself. You got Linda on organ as well. But the way they were recording it, you think it's obviously Paul's on bass and drums, but obviously drums need to be recorded first. So all of these songs, however complex they are, it's just Paul on drums and probably Denny just strumbling around the guitar to get the tune going. And there's some long old songs on here. Mm-hmm. And you forget that to have all that music in your head just playing drums, which is basically data.
Yeah, yeah.
While keeping the music going in your head, it blows my head off.
They're playing to the band in their minds, aren't they? So they're sort of like, they're having an amazing time just playing with a full band, which only really sort of presumably fully exists in their heads. Which really is a testament to the strength of these songs. You know, these songs sort of tell you that they're going to sound amazing, especially when they're done. And
I think, again, obviously the Lennon reference as well. It could also be turned on its head because Beef Jerky then uses this riff as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's intentional or not, but it is very close.
It's lovely. So they're all sort of, it's brilliant. I love that sort of reference. You know, they're Beatles even when they're not Beatles. And sometimes that's a curse, but, you know, they understand that that's the deal, you know. And that's what makes it so sad in some ways, that they are all kind of, you know, they are, you know, especially with John, you know, I find this quite a sad decade in some ways for John, because I just sort of think that, you know, John needed Paul a bit more than Paul needed John. They all needed each other, but, and John wasn't very good at hiding that. Maybe he thought he was better at hiding it than he was. Thank you.
flipping over to side two, Mamounia.
We now, I think with this, we're really now getting, we're sort of drilling into the heart of Paul's character, and we're pretty much there now. We're right in the centre of what makes Paul, Paul. The key lines for me are, you know, the rain comes falling from the sky to build a stream that fills the sea, and that's where life began for you and me. So next time you see rain, it ain't bad. Don't complain, it rains for you. Next time you see LA rain clouds, don't complain, it rains for you and me. And I just genuinely believe that those are songs that you can live your life by. And I come back to them again and again. And I, you know, I talk to my family about them. You know, this is a lyric that can make you a better human being. And this is like the Zen of Paul. You know, it's sort of, it's the same wellspring as, you know, later on With a Little Luck, he sings the willow turns his back on inclement weather. And if he can do it, then we can do it. And even we all stand together, you know, win or lose, sink or swim. One thing is certain, we'll never give in. Side by side, hand in hand, we all stand together. You know, it's all part of the same stuff for me, really. Yeah. Just sort of, you just have to work with what you've got, you know. And people might say, well, of course it's easy for him to say that, but he's a millionaire and, you know, he's got everything he wants. But
so was John.
So is, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's, and so, you know, sometimes with greater sort of wealth and success and attention, you're just sort of lost in a blizzard, you know, and you can't sort of separate. There's just all this stuff, and you can't separate the stuff that is really going to make you happy and fulfilled and the stuff that's going to distract you from that. And Paul and Linda just sort of, I think, maybe reassured each other that over time, it's not banal to kind of take delight in little things. It might actually be the point. And And I think, and they got a lot of flack for it in the 70s, because actually these are all realizations that, you know, we have sort of, you know, if we're lucky enough to become parents and see, you know, step outside of ourselves, then these are all the things we subsequently realize to be true, and all the sort of emotions that get disparaged by people who think that there's something more truthful about gazing into the abyss are sort of valid. And and so I think he kind of worked that out earlier than most of us did. So, you know, Mamounia, I think, is as deep a song as Eleanor Rigby or Because, you know, or, you know, any of the ones that sort of get maybe revered more critically in that way. Well, you know, it's the same point, you know, silly love songs. I just love that about silly love songs. What's wrong with that? And I absolutely think that this is the heart of it. I remember reading an interview with Teenage Fan Club in the 90s, and they were being challenged a little bit on, you know, their sort of reliance on kind of pretty melodies when maybe they could be doing something a little bit more avant-garde. And they said, you know, like with their tongue in cheek, but never, they sort of said that, well, the average person who's been working in a factory fastening sheets of metal together or down a mine spends their whole day listening to atonal noise. So that when they go home, they want to hear a melody, they want to hear something pretty to sort of take their minds off it. And I think it is kind of interesting that, you know, certainly in my life, a lot of people I've known that have been real sort of evangelists for avant-garde music to the exclusion of the other stuff tend to be people that often have come from quite comfortable backgrounds. I like both. I really love music which has elements of both together, you know. But but anyway, so I think these all sort of feed into my defense of Paul. I'm very conscious that you've hardly spoken, and I've
Seriously, these are the best ones. I'm the most boring person in the world. No one wants to hear me.
No. I'm happy to. You know, feel free to interject. Tell me what.
No, I'm just sitting here enjoying it. I'll get your free Pete Pavidis performance here. So yeah, I'm fine.
wanna give your love away and end up giving nothing. I'm not surprised that your black eyes are gazing. You say that love is everything, and what we need the most of. I wish you knew that's just how true.
So then we got No Words after that. Bit of a favourite?
I would say this is Denny Lane's peak in Wings for me.
Yeah. He's quite unassuming about his role in Wings, isn't he? He calls himself the odd job man in Wings.
Yeah.
Which is very sweet. Denny Lane went to the same school as me. That's probably the most famous thing about my school. Yeah. It was a grammar school at the time, but although by the time I got there, it had become a secondary modern school, and it was kind of going down the pipes, sort of.
Is that because of you or because of Denny?
I was definitely part of the problem. No, I was part of the problem. Yeah, no, it was difficult to get into it when Denny was there. He was a grammar school child. So Denny's clever, far cleverer than me. And, literally true. Yeah, so it's lovely that Denny was sort of, didn't really sort of, I think one of the marks of how easygoing Denny was that a lot of those early gigs, I guess Paul was kind of wanted to play songs that were familiar without necessarily just playing Beatles, you know, it was too early to sort of try and prop himself up with Beatles songs. So they put Go Now by the Moody Blues into the set, which was the big Moody Blues hit that from when Denny was in the band. That's very nice of Denny to, because it's not even a song that Denny wrote. It was a Bessie Banks song, which they covered. And so it's very nice of Denny to sort of say, yeah, we can do that. You know, I'll step forward and not too happy not to sort of really assert his own agenda. So I can see why, and you know, obviously he came to Lagos as well, and seemed to enjoy it.
Well, you see, all the others that went by the wayside, all these other Wings members, and Denny, you do get the feeling before he joined Wings, he was kind of sleeping rough in his manager's office. And then he got a one-bedroom flat, and I think he was quite happy with his lot in many ways, but... So he never really enforced himself on Wings, and I think he was, that's fine, I'll do that, Paul.
I think that's a Midlands thing. I think generally, you know, you sort of, having grown up in the same postcode as Denny Lane, I think I can sort of say, you know, your expectations are fairly sort of low, and and if you exceed them in any way at all, then you're good, you know, the glass is half full, you know, and... And I, you know, I'm getting this a lot at the moment because, you know, people have been very nice about my book and people sort of say, well, when's the next one going to come along? And I'm sort of like saying, well, you know, I've written one more than I thought I would. And so I'll try and write another one. But to be honest, I'm really, you know, I'm winning here. You know, I'm so far beyond my loftiest expectations as a child. I'm sort of happy to, if people just want to invite me out to dinner and kind of afternoon kind of cocktail parties just on the basis of this, I'm available. I'm not currently standing behind the counter of my parents' fish and chip shop, and that is a daily win for me. So, but anyway, so Denny Lane, I like them. I don't have too much to say about it, but I never skip it, because there's nothing I skip on this album. Apart from on the CD, maybe some on certain versions of the CD, Helen Wheels. Sometimes, but that wasn't on the original album.
That was the thing, it was released a few weeks before the album as a single, And Paul was, no, it's not going on the album. And obviously in Capitol Records, saying, you know, you've got to, it's been a big single, try and promote the album.
Yeah.
And they were kind of right. I think nowadays he's probably listening to Capitol more. And the fact that he was reluctant also to release Jet and Band on the Run.
Mm.
And the album, when it was initially released, it was a bit of a slow burner. You know, it took a while to get into the top 10. But it was only once he released the singles that it really, really pushed it into another stratosphere. So he doesn't seem to be aware of his own.
No, a lot of artists, actually, I've got to say, over the years, I've noticed that about a lot of artists. They don't really know what their big bankers are, in a way. And I realise it's quite far back. I remember Radiohead. I interviewed them quite a lot in the early days. And I remember, you know, they really agonised over the recording of their second album, The Bend. And one of the issues that almost sort of tore them apart was there's a song on the album called Sulk, which I think most people would agree that it's probably one of the most, you know, it's okay, but it's not. It's one of the more unremarkable songs on that record. And everyone just at the label and, you know, members of the band as well got it into their heads that that was the song, that was the single that was going to just really, that might sort of almost emulate Creep. Because at that point, Creep was really becoming an albatross for them. And anyway, they finally finished the album. It was quite a torturous recording. And Sulk ultimately never even made it as a single. You know, they kind of stood their ground. I think Tom was the only one who didn't want to release it as a single.
Yeah.
And whoever talks about Sulk by Radiohead being a great lost single, it's just these things kind of sort of sometimes...
Yeah.
There are loads of examples of just songs that, you know, for some reason the label thought that it would be the one. And Helen Wheels, so, you know, now with our sort of fresh ears, we can sort of hear that Helen Wheels is a, you know, it's a nice song and it has a certain kind of forward kind of momentum. It's also got that lyrical reference to Sailor Sam, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if it was, I think it might have been written after Band on the Run because... In the lyric to Band on the Run, Sailor Sam sort of serves to complete the internal rhyme on that line. And the rhyme on Helen Wheels isn't as clean a rhyme. So that makes me think that Band on the Run came before Helen Wheels. But anyway, such detective work. notwithstanding.
Track three, Picasso's Last Words, recorded at Ginger Baker's Arc Studios. Because Paul basically picked a load of EMI studios, saw they had them all over the world and thought, you know, let's go away and do... So many of his albums do that. Let's just go away and record them. So they just picked, yeah, that sounds nice, Nigeria, not realising there'd recently been a coup and there was cholera. And all this sort of thing, so...
Well, there was no internet, there was no... Sort of, you couldn't know, really. It was hard to find out what countries were like.
That was it. And obviously the story itself, he went to a party, Dustin Hoffman said, oh, can you write about anything? Picked up the Time article on Picasso. Everyone was really impressed. I suppose once Dustin Hoffman is running around the room screaming, wow, this man's a genius, it's going to go on the album, isn't it?
Yeah. he said it was right under childbirth in terms of the great events of his life. Dustin Hoffman, not Paul. Have you seen that the interview with Dermot O'Leary that was on the telly a few years ago?
Yeah.
And there's a great bit in that where, definitely worth looking up, where Paul explains, you know, because they're in Montego Bay and he's kind of, he sees that there's a film shoot going on, which is, like you said, Papillon. Yeah. And then he says, you know, at that point, you know, he's quite curious to see what's going on in there. So at that point, I try and look like me because he wants to be recognised so he can get in. Yeah. And he does a great... I love that moment because he does... He does Paul McCartney doing an impression of Paul McCartney.
Yes, yeah.
Which is... Yeah. He says, hello, it's me. And so, like, he, what, you know, what's it? So that's kind of... That's the reason why it happened, because he basically blagged...
He was doing the same... Yeah, he blagged... He was doing Paul as he did in the Coming Up video.
Yes, yes.
It's Paul doing Paul. And you would... Yeah, okay, yeah, come in, yeah. Stop everything.
Of course, so absolutely, he's probably quite, he's entitled to turn it on when he wants to turn it on. And so that's kind of essentially what he did. Again, you know, that I like the fact that there's kind of, you get fragments of Jet and Mrs. Vanderbilt in it, you know. So, I do love albums where you get that kind of interreferential thing going on in different songs. And this is the one with Ginger Baker on it, isn't it? So he's kind of like, he's playing gravel, isn't he, on this percussion. So, and this Paul...
Which must have been, you think Ginger, right, I've got Paul McCartney here. I get the impression Paul did this part, not out of guilt as much, but kind of, well, you know, we've got a bit of history, you know. I'm sure Ginger, I'll come round. I think it might have been like that. And I'm wondering if the back of Ginger's mind is thinking, well, yeah, I'll be playing drums on this. Don't know. Oh, here's a tin can full of gravel, Ginge. I don't know.
It's quite it's a subtle kind of... it's a subtle bit of trolling if it is, but it's all, you know, it's a beautiful arrangement, and you know, everyone's kind of at their best here, and I like Paul's sort of explanation that they're trying to mirror or at least nod in the song to the different phases of Picasso's life, breaking it down and cutting it up. And but again, I think this is a function of Paul's incredibly relaxed attitude to songwriting. He's always doing it, he's always on, he's always receiving, and I think this is partly why sometimes, you know, on other records the quality level kind of goes down, because he's just always on, you know. It's not a big deal for him to write a song, so it's very serendipitous, because Dustin Hoffman didn't have to show him that copy of Life magazine. And if he hadn't, then Paul McCartney would never have written a song about Picasso. But in that moment of serendipity, there is a sort of parallel that establishes itself, which is, you know, like Picasso's sort of, you know, lifelong mission to sort of to learn to draw like a child. Yeah, you know, to sort of unlearn the things that constrain you in adulthood. And, you know, there are definitely, that's definitely a strain of that, I think, in a lot of the kind of songs that Paul has written over the years. And sometimes it results in absolutely brilliant songs, and sometimes it sort of slightly goes the other way. But you can always, the intention is honourable. So for me, a less successful example of it is on the, is it Dance Tonight, on the first song on Memory Almost Full?
Yeah.
Doesn't work for me, but I can sort of see... It could have worked, you know. It's an honourable idea, but then you get there are other songs on which it kind of works like an absolute dream, you know. And you know, it's just, you know, like this one from Flowers in the Dirt, and so, you know, it's but it's an honourable sort of objective, definitely, you know. And, you know, people like Jonathan Richman have kind of based their entire sort of aesthetic on a sort of similar approach. Picasso's Last Words is anything but a simple song, ultimately. You know, it's in some ways it's the most, you know, one of the most impressive songs on the record. It's absolutely beautiful. It actually gives the lie to one of my favourite singer-songwriters is... a guy called Robert Forster, who was in a group called the Go-Betweens, and he wrote... For people who don't know, anyway. He's a great writer as well, as a prose writer, and he had an anthology of articles published about 15 years ago called The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll. And the reason it was called that was because there was the opening article, which was a very, very short article, just called The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll. mostly quite funny, but kind of quite wise. You know, for instance, one of them was, anyone who changes their guitar more than three times during the course of a gig is just trying to show you how many guitars they've got. anyway, one of the rules.
No was, names.
one of the rules is the second last song on the album is the best place to hide the worst track, which patently is not true in the case of Picasso and Wordsworth. So really,
well, with pretty well every Paul McCartney album, I'd say.
Right. Okay. I'd have to go away and think about that. But you would know more than me. You have a more instant recall. So I would put, if I was going to put Helen Wheels on any part of this album, I'd put it as the penultimate track.
Obviously, that Paul mentions the Picasso thing, but I would say the one song that this really reminds me of, the way with using the same theme in different segments, is "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number."
Oh.
Which is effectively the same principle.
Yes. Wow. I never thought of that. That's amazing.
Because John was very keen originally just to keep it the same all the way through for 15 minutes. And I think Paul's big input was, well, no, come on, let's do the cha-cha-cha and whatever and the game sections, which is kind of what he's doing here.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's classic Paul as well, just drawing from sensibilities that sit outside of music to broaden his lexicon of songwriting tools. And and you know, he's just fantastic at that. He was never completely sold on any one genre at any one time. He's always, one of the beautiful things about him is that he's completely egalitarian in his outlook. You know, it's he doesn't distinguish between high art and low art, between this genre, between that era and that era. It's all fair game. It's all fuel. And now we're all a bit more like that. We're all a bit eclectic because we can, you know, we can kind of handpick anything we want from any era to listen to. But it wasn't, you know, people generally were not so much like that back in those days. So we come to your favourite song on the album. I asked you earlier what you liked about it, but you can tell me again if you like.
Everything. I think it's just, this is up there in my top five Macca songs ever. It's just the sheer passion of it. It pounds along. He did try and recreate this with Morse Moose and the Grey Goose a few years later to less effect. I think he took this as a template. Not one of David Quantick despises that song. I think he uses that when he said, what was it? If Paul ever says, well, don't you know who I am? I wrote Yesterday. Yeah, you also wrote Yesterday. But it's just a sheer piece of genius. It just builds in the swell of the orchestra. And obviously, right at the very end, you've got the, oh, okay, reprise.
It's
which Paul did love.
It's sort of a bid for glory, isn't it? And it's sort of it gives the album a lovely symmetrical kind of evenness to it, because it's sort of it literally sounds like a band on the run, you know, just they are sort of not walking it home, but kind of running it home, making their sort of grand escape. And it's such a it could only have ever ended with this album, you know. I'm trying to remember, I've seen people say, you know, there's I think Andrew Grant Jackson referred to the lyrics as gibberish and mere placeholders for the I'd say fuck off, really, you know. Just like, I got that with Howard Souness's book. Have you read Howard Souness's book? Fucking hell, it's just sort of, it's like the least interesting thing to him is Paul's music. It's like he wants to talk about almost anything, but the, and you know, when he finally sort of begrudgingly addresses the content of this album. He's just so supercilious and joyless. Like he has to, like Paul has to impress Howard Souness. Who's Howard Souness? You know, like
he played for Glasgow Rangers.
Not even. If only Graham Souness would have far more right to to pick that record apart. You know.
Apologies to the Souness family if you're listening.
Oh, Howard, sorry. Yeah, but he's. But then he got my goat on page 5 when he got the name of We All Stand Together wrong. He called it the Frog Song or something.
Oh, right.
And I thought, okay, well, you've sort of lost me now. But I did sort of, I persevered for a bit. he's very disparaging about the lyrics. And, you know, he's one of the, but it's that classic sort of, a lot of, I've got to say, predominantly white rock music writers of the 70s are really hung up on every line having to sort of earn its place in the song, and everything having to mean something sort of specific, and everything. And that's really the kind of thinking that kind of led people into thinking that John's 70s were kind of more glorious than Paul's in a way. But that's not how, you know, I'm not a songwriter, but I've met enough songwriters now and to know that that's not how songwriting works, and that's not how you kind of write.
What you were saying earlier about John, Paul was taking support after the split from his family, and John was kind of taking support from militant groups and 70s rock journalists.
Yeah, yeah.
To get his worth. And obviously he's going to stick with, well, right, power to the people, here we go.
Yeah, you know, and it was still, you know, even when Starting Over, just like Starting Over came out, he still had people like Charles Sharp Murray saying, oh, look at what's happened to him. You know, this dopey, soppy git, you know, is just sold out. He's, you know, the kind of the radicalised firebrand of the early 70s. And I just don't buy that at all. I think it's far braver to write a song like Woman or just like Starting Over than it is to write Give Me Some Truth or whatever. I mean, it's fine. It's all great. You know, I don't mean to disparage those early songs. But,
well, it's not the songs. I'm saying more about the actual journalism.
Yeah,
the time,
yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's just there's this kind of lobby of people sort of egging you on to do something that actually is not, that's not how normal people, you know, in the everyday world of being a music fan, you know, listening to your favourite songs on the bus or whatever, I don't think that's really how you judge the value of music to you in your life. I don't think, you know, it's nice when a song is original, but I don't think originality is a determinant of quality. Just as, you know, I don't, you know, when a song is derivative, it doesn't mean that it's not any good or it's not going to make you happy, you know. They just sort of come to you. And I think Paul had a lot of that stuff figured out, you know, before a lot of people did.
I think what you were saying earlier about when you were kids and how the music impacts you more because your imagination just, it's like listening to the Goons or whatever radio shows, you just fill in the blanks. One thing I remember about this, my elder brother, his mate was the bloke in the street who had all the albums. And I remember I inherited my elder brother's Loitron stereo recorder, and it had a tape and a record player, so finally I could tape music. And I borrowed this guy's copy of Band on the Run. Gosh, I don't know how old I was, 7, I don't know. And listen, I just sat transfixed, mesmerised by this amazing music I was hearing. And then it got to this song, and then it hit the bit with the... I was, if you can imagine a 7-year-old taking drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I felt at the time. It was the most amazing thing I'd, it was heavenly.
But I think that
and to this day.
That's absolutely what being a 7-year-old is like. You know, I don't think, it is like a sort of drug state. You know, when you love a song, you will play it 20 times in a row. It's like a complete, you know, you are, you do, yeah. you, these are the deranged gestures of adoration that you kind of commit to at that age. You know, you sort of, it's all or nothing. You are just completely, you're obsessive and manic, and everything is just supersized and multiplied at that age. And and that's a sort of an absolute case in point, you know. And so that's kind of what, that's the sort of, you know, sensory overload in a way that I was trying to sort of get into the headspace of when I was writing my book. You know, we are more connected to music in some ways than we might ever be again. And also, I think, I honestly believe that I made smarter decisions about the music I liked when I was 10 than when I was 25. When I was 25, I'd just become a music journalist. And I was slightly closer. I was trying to be closer to that kind of Charles Shaw Murray sort of chin-stroking, performatively edgy strain of music journalism. If you asked me what I liked when I was 10, I would have just I would have told you, and I would have been completely honest. And I might not have had the vocabulary to tell you exactly why I like, you know, I can go back now and I can remember the emotions, I can kind of figure it all out. But that, you know, you can't ascribe concepts like stupid or clever to emotions. Emotions that sit outside of those constructs. You know, emotions are just emotions, and they're not clever or stupid. They are just, you feel them because, for all sorts of reasons, but you feel them and they're there, and you cannot deny their validity. My reaction to Mull of Kintyre as an 8-year-old is absolutely as valid to my, you know, reaction to a Kendrick Lamar record now. It's not cleverer. It's not less clever. It's just, they're just emotions. And our job as human beings, when asked about them, is to try and explain those emotions, why they exist, as honestly as possible.
Pete Perfides, it's been an absolute joy. Can I just ask, overall, Band on the Run, what does it mean to you now?
It reminds me that if the chips are down and you're up against it, you want to have a Paul McCartney in your camp. And if they can, and if they happen to be the best songwriter in the world, then, well, that's an album that's a lifetime keeper.
Pete Perfides, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey!